Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. If you are a regular listener, why not plan to visit Beth Emmanuel in beautiful Hudson, Wisconsin for one of the holidays? Join us in the fall for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, or Sukkot, or come visit in the springtime and spend Passover or Shavuot with us. All the holidays are special at Beth Emmanuel. You can contact us to request details by clicking on the Contact tab on our website. And remember to support Beth Emmanuel with your prayers and financial gifts.
We were learning about the various, what you could call, theological systems and methods of interpreting the Bible, whereby Christianity has historically come to the conclusion that the vast majority of the Bible isn't relevant anymore, okay? So most followers of Jesus, most of our brothers and sisters, most Christians, believe that the teachings of the Bible used to be authoritative in days gone by, in the days before Jesus, but today, a majority of the things in here have been fulfilled, done away with, abolished, made obsolete, etc., etc., expired, like yogurt, you know, that's been in the refrigerator too long. But that premise has raised a basic question, which I posed last week, and here is the question: why? Why? Why did people have to keep what we are calling the ceremonial law before the resurrection, but not after the resurrection? Or you can move the point around a little bit if you want. You can put it this way: why did people have to keep the ceremonial law before Acts chapter 2, but not after Acts chapter 2? I don't care where you set it, but it's obviously someplace right there in the New Testament era where the big flip happened. And last week I explained that by ceremonial law, I mean those aspects of the Torah which generally pertain to the diet, the dietary laws, the calendar, the holy days, the purity laws, and the Levitical system of worship, including the temple, the priesthood, the sacrifices, all right, that we read about in the Bible. So let me ask it again. Why did people have to keep this stuff before Jesus and aren't supposed to keep it after Jesus? So this is starting to sound familiar. Remember, we were talking about this last week. Good. As I explained, there's been several attempts to answer this question. That's what we were working on last week. And on the one hand, you know what? If you think about this isn't really our problem. This isn't our problem. And maybe you could make the argument that it's none of our business. It's not our problem because in Messianic Judaism, we believe that the Torah was not canceled or repealed in any sense, not even the ceremonial commandments, not even the least of the commandments, as our master clearly states. Don't think that. And so we don't think that. He says, don't think that, so we don't think that. It's very clear. And he says, whoever keeps and teaches the least of these commandments, and so on and so forth. So maybe this is none of our business, and what are we even talking about this for? But on the other hand, I think it is our problem because the implication of the conclusion defames our master as a destroyer of the Torah, which is blasphemy, God forbid. And I believe that we have the obligation to defend his reputation. So for that reason, we are looking at these common explanations of why the ceremonial law is not binding after the resurrection. And the main one we were looking at last week was something called allegorizing. Remember I said I came up with three topics. Allegorizing, which is to take it figuratively and not literally. And then the second is dispensationalism, which is what we're going to talk about today. And then the third is something I made up called homogenizing, which we'll get to. It's like milk. Homogenizing. You homogenize it. Anyway, so last week we were learning about allegorizing. Today we're learning about dispensationalism, a favorite approach among many evangelical Protestants, this theological system called dispensationalism. Are you a dispensationalist? I mean, what is it to be a dispensationalist? I think you are probably a dispensationalist. You can be a dispensationalist and not even know it. Did you realize that? Yeah. So I guess as I looked at dispensationalism, I decided I was. I decided, yeah, you know what? That's what I am too. I am a dispensationalist, but not, you know, I'm a bad dispensationalist with some, I'm not a classical dispensationalist, but I have some dispensationalist ideas, as I'll explain. But let me explain what this is in the first place. It's, first of all, dispensationalism is ism, six syllables. That's a lot. That's a mouthful, huh? What is a dispensation? What is a dispensationalist? A dispensationalist is very simple. Just remember this. A dispensationalist is someone who believes in dispensations. That's very easy. So what is a dispensation? Well, in this context, this theological context, a dispensation means this. It means a time frame, a period of time, an epoch, an era, during which a religious doctrine or practice is believed to be in force. Okay, so it's a period of time where things are a certain way. I don't know. How's that? Anyway, the theology, which you've all heard about before, arose as an attempt to answer a question, I believe. And the question was, one of the questions was, why do people have to keep the ceremonial law before the resurrection, but not after the resurrection? I think that was one of the things beating around that brought about this theology. Dispensationalism answers it this way, suggests that God, well, what the thing is that God, you know, he changes his mind once in a while. And as a result, you know, it's like, tried that, let's do something else. So he has different standards of obedience in different eras or different dispensations. And what pleased them at one time, for example, he says, I really like sacrifices. Bring me a lot of sacrifices. And he's like, I'm sick of sacrifices. You know, no more sacrifices. What pleased them at one time is not what's going to please them in the next dispensation. And so it can be, and then maybe, you know, he'll be back. Hey, I kind of missed the sacrifices. Let's get those going again. You know, so things change for different dispensations. And in different periods, there's different modes then also of approaching God, in different modes of serving him, different modes of obedience, and ultimately, if you really nail this down, different modes of attaining salvation. I'll give you some examples of a classical dispensationalist approach. In the classical approach, as I understand it, there are seven, count them, seven, that's the magic number, seven dispensations. There's, well, first of all, there was Adam. He only had one commandment. So Adam and Eve, in innocence, living in total innocence in the Garden of Eden, up until the fall, that's one dispensation. Dispensation number two is conscience. That's after Adam sinned, and then now sin is in the world. Man should just know better, but he acts against his conscience. He should know better and not do so much robbery and immorality, but he doesn't, and so God punishes him with a flood. That's number two, conscience, and that ends with the flood. After the flood, this dispensation is called, some people call it government. And that's where we have the New Deal. God says to Noah, I'm going to give you a few standards. Here's what I want. You're going to have to have a few rules. And by the way, help yourself to the animals. Have some meat. Work a little meat into your diet. And then there's the death penalty. He introduces the death penalty too at this time. And this is the dispensation up until the call of Abraham. And what do we get with Abraham? With Abraham, God says, I'm going to make some promises to you, Abraham. I'm going to make you great, make your name great, make you a great nation. And you don't have to lift a finger. And this is the dispensation of promise. And this lasts up until the Torah. At the point of the giving of the law, he says, okay, there's going to be some rules. And he gives us a bunch of rules. And these are this is the Torah. And this lasts up until the cross. Of course, the Torah gets nailed to the cross. And then we start the dispensation of grace. It's like, okay, forget the rules. You know what? You're all in. Just believe in the boy. Believe in the son, you know? And you're all in. Now we're under the dispensation of grace. And we go to the... And this lasts, but don't get too comfortable. Because this expires with the rapture. And at the rapture, then the millennial kingdom comes and we're back to the law. Back to the law on earth for 1,000 years. And that's the last dispensation, the millennial kingdom. All right. So that's sort of a parody presentation. But there are, and there's a lot of different variations on this scheme and many, many, many different forms of people say, well, I think there's, you forgot about this dispensation and this one. And there's even like someone called a hyper-dispensationalist. A hyper-dispensationalist, he breaks it down. It's like, well, you had a different period between the resurrection and Acts 2, and then there's another one between Acts 2, the giving of the Spirit, and the end of the book of Acts when Paul throws up his hand and says, okay, I'm done with the Jews. I'm going only to the Gentiles. Then the dispensation of the Gentiles starts. And, so you can break this down even. Or there's people who say, that's too complicated. This is a lot simpler than that. There was law and grace, and so that's all sorts of different ways of presenting this. But one major premise of dispensationalism is that prior to the Messiah, God wanted people to keep the law. And after the Messiah, he didn't. And therefore, there's been a change in God's expectations. So in the dispensationalist scheme of things, when you are going to read the Bible as a dispensationalist, your first duty should really be to figure out what dispensation it is that you're reading about. Anything to the left side of Matthew is suspicious territory. That could belong to a different dispensation. Probably does belong to a different dispensation. So it's the dispensational scheme of things that we're talking about. And most of the laws of the Torah belong to the dispensation of, well, naturally, law. So it's on this basis that you can forget about the Sabbath, festivals, food laws, forget it, not even a second thought, because those were for a different era. They don't apply to us. They were canceled at the cross. And it's a pretty clever theology, dispensationalism. You have to give it credit. And but really, it's not, and it's primarily a Protestant thing, but it's really just a development on something that's been around since the second century. And Catholics have even had a form of dispensationalism all along. It's a lot simpler if you're Catholic. There's two dispensations. There's before Peter and after Peter. Because, before Peter, there was, the law. And after Peter, the law was given to Peter to, bind and to loose. And so Peter says, Acts 15, gets everyone together and lifts off the Torah. And it's like, and so, it's a lot simpler. Messiah gave Peter binding and loosing prerogative. Therefore, the church becomes the arbitrator of truth and law. So if the church changes a law, it's changed. Period. And God's okay with that. And after the cross, the church unbound the law, and the center of authority is not God's word, it's the Roman Catholic Church. And this is why Catholic theologians are not shy about telling the truth about things. You talk to a Roman Catholic theologian and say, what, isn't Sabbath supposed to be on Saturday? They're like, oh yeah, we changed that. we did. We changed that a long time ago. And to be fair, it's not just a Roman Catholic idea. The whole church basically believed in this two-dispensation idea. It was called the Age of Israel. Israel, the Jewish days, the days of Israel, that's Old Testament days. And then the Church Age, that's the New Testament days. And so this is, even though dispensationalism trots around like it's a brand new thing, it's actually been around since the earliest days of Christianity. So in many ways, it's just a refinement of that old formula. Okay, all right. Now, that was a fairly crass oversimplification of dispensationalism. It's actually a pretty good theological system. And in reality, most of us in the Messianic movement, like I was saying, are a type of dispensationalist. And to understand what I mean by that, and why that is, let me tell you just a little bit about how this whole thing got rolling, dispensationalism. Prior to this idea of epochs and eras, dispensationalism, the church did not believe in a coming kingdom of heaven on earth. Not in the literal sense. So for most of Christian history, the church has not believed in a literal coming kingdom of heaven on earth. Certainly did not believe in the restoration of the Jewish people, or the literal return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, or their rise to power during the millennium. In fact, the church no longer believed in a millennium at all. And those who did, well, there was a name for them. They're called Kilius, which just means millennial nuts. And this goes back to the 3rd century, maybe a little earlier even. So prior to dispensationalism, the church no longer believed in Messiah coming back and ruling and reigning literally in Jerusalem as king. Prior to dispensationalism, the church taught that God had utterly rejected the Jewish people forever and ever, and that the nation of Israel had no future hope except unless Jews left Judaism and became Christians and joined the church. There was no Israel because the church was now the new Israel. All of that was status quo for Christian theology until the latter decades of the 19th century. We're talking recent history. When the Spirit of God was moving in remarkable ways to restore His people. Those were the days of Franz Delitzsch, of Liechtenstein, of the other Liechtenstein, of Levertov, Wiesenthal, Lucky, and a host of other Jewish believers. And at the same time, a Christian theologian from the Brethren movement, named John Nelson Darby, was writing and making some astute observations on the biblical text, and he realized that we were wrong on a lot of stuff regarding Israel and eschatology, and that if Israel does not have a future and the kingdom is not literal, then the Bible is wrong. He came up against that. So he introduced a new idea, and here it is. The new idea is that the nation of Israel is distinct from the Christian church and that God has yet to fulfill His promises to national Israel, and He will yet do so. And these promises include a return to the land of Israel. Remember, this is before the modern return to the land of Israel. This is when Zionism was still an idea. This is before the Zionist conferences. So he was teaching that Israel must return to the land. He was teaching a literal kingdom. He was teaching a third temple and a 1,000-year rule of Messiah in Jerusalem. That was his idea, and it's the same thing we are always teaching. We call it the kingdom of heaven. He called it the millennium, the kingdom dispensation. It's a period of time. And this was radical stuff. But it raised a problem for him. As he looked at the prophecies, he had to wonder, where are all the Christians in this kingdom? So he came up with a solution. He got rid of them. He got rid of them by rapturing them off of the planet before the millennial kingdom begins. It was a new idea. It was his innovation. He raptures them off the planet before the kingdom begins. So John Darby is regarded as the father of the rapture. Nobody talked about a rapture in the church before John Darby, early 19th century. I would have preferred it, now from my own reading of the Bible, if he was going to rapture us someplace, if John Darby had raptured us to Messianic Jerusalem, along with the exiles of Israel at the great ingathering that comes at the trumpet of Messiah. But you know what? I'm not going to quibble over that, you know, right now. That's, you know, we can go to heaven. I'm fine with that. Whatever. Wherever the, you know, just give me a ticket. The point is that dispensationalism was a major reversal of a much older form of dispensationalism. In the older form of dispensationalism, there were only two dispensations, Israel and the church, like I told you. The age of Israel, which lasted until the resurrection, or until Acts 2, or until the end of the book of Acts, whatever. And then the age of the church. And this is also called supersessionism. It's like a superhero. Should get a t-shirt. Supersessionism. Not just sessionism. Supersessionism. Because here's why. It's based on the word supersede. Because the church basically superseded Israel, replaced Israel. So what I am saying is that Darby's dispensationalism, on the whole, has been a very good thing. A welcome return. It's the trumpet of the Lord. It's already here. It's the car alarm of the Lord. There were seven. Teruah. So I am saying that dispensationalism, on the whole, has been a very good thing, a welcome return to a much more apostolic view of eschatology, which means end time stuff, and the role of Israel. I grew up under it without even knowing it. And I owe my understanding of the scriptures and Israel to that theological background. Christian Zionists exist and are Zionists only because they are dispensationalists. Prior to dispensationalism, Christianity had no room or interest for the Jewish people, the land of Israel as Jewish land, or the kingdom of heaven on earth. And dispensationalism was a prophetic movement that went through the church just prior to the time when Zionism took off. It anticipated it, so to speak, prophetically, and it rocked the Christian world. And today, people who call themselves evangelicals, fundamentalists, Baptists, independents, charismatics, Pentecostals, generally speaking, all of the above and everything that's similar to them, whether they know it or not, they are dispensationalists. If you believe in a rapture, you're definitely a dispensationalist. If you believe in the second coming of the Messiah in this world rather than after this world is over, then you are probably a dispensationalist. So what's the problem with dispensationalism? Well, you know me. I'm never happy with anything. And there are a few problems. For the most part, I think it's on target. But from a Messianic Jewish perspective, a few caveats are necessary. It requires us to distinguish between the dispensation of Israel and the dispensation of grace, or the dispensation of the church, whatever you want to call it. Therefore, separating between the church and Israel and making them into completely different entities in the sense that God has two completely distinct peoples. It's like he's, you know, I always put it this way. It's like God's a polygamist, and it's his Jewish wife and then his Gentile wife, you know. Is like God's bride and his other bride, or, you know, I don't know, maybe it's his daughter-in-law. Maybe the church is his daughter-in-law. I never thought of it that way. This is the bride of Christ, you know. That would make the Jewish people the church's mother-in-law. No wonder there's friction there. That makes sense. It's all coming together for me now. Anyway, this means that, like, if you take this approach, this means that you have to pick and choose from the scriptures. You have to say, okay, this applies, here to this dispensation, this would apply here to this dispensation, and this was to the age of Israel, and this is, you know, but this is for the church age, and it's an arbitrary process. But it does answer the question, why do people have to do this before but don't have to do it now? Well, the whole thing with the ceremonial law is settled then, because it's all like, that's all Israel, and it's not part of the dispensation of grace. Okay, so I have a problem. Yeah, I have a problem with that. So if I say, a pastor dispensationalist, can you tell me why we no longer keep the Sabbath? He'd say, well, you know, the Sabbath belongs to the dispensation of law. And we're not under the dispensation of law, we're under the dispensation of grace. But it will be practiced again in the dispensation of the kingdom. So if you really want to be a Sabbatarian, you just have to miss the rapture. And then you'll get a chance to live in the dispensation of the millennium, when the ceremonial law will be back. This idea messes with another theological concept that's called the immutability of God. In other words, God's unchangingness. Remember what we heard in the Torah today. When Balaam gave us this word, he said, God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has God said, and he will not do it? Has he spoken, and he will not make it good? This is the God who said, I will be as I will be, which means I don't change. So dispensationalism requires a God who changes without even giving you so much as a heads up. The switch from, you have to admit, the switch from Israel to the church was a pretty hard, fast, unanticipated left turn and threw a lot of people out of the car. Then there's the eternal statutes problem. Last week it was Parshat Chukat, and we're talking about Chukat, and you know the statute, and there's that, you know, how often it says in the Torah regarding the ceremonial laws of the priesthood and the temple and the tabernacle, it says this is, and the calendar, it says this is a Chukat Olam, an eternal statute. It's more than 30 times in the Torah. You know, so if you read a concordance or a lexicon written by a dispensationalist, olam means, they'll translate that, for an age, chukat olam, a statute for an age, yeah, rather than it's an eternal statute. They'll say no, it means it's a statute for a dispensation. It's a statute for an age. It's not what it means. Another big problem with dispensationalism is that Yeshua and the apostles weren't dispensationalists. They were, you know, of course, Torah-keeping Jews, and the Bible of the apostles was the Tanakh, and they constantly appealed to their Bibles as their basis for faith and practice, and not to a New Testament which didn't exist. And not only for Jewish believers, but also for God-fearing Gentile disciples, the Gentile Christians. And when Jesus gave orders to his disciples to make disciples of all nations, he instructed these new disciples, he said, tell them everything I've commanded you. And this would, of course, include his teaching regarding the Torah, which was, namely, that it wasn't abolished, and that they should keep its commandments. Not that I'm suggesting that they should become Jews, but that they should keep the commandments in the Torah that applied to them as Gentiles. And the apostles continued to offer sacrifices and to congregate in the temple and so forth. And all of these things indicate that when the dispensation changed, nobody told them. So where does Messianic Judaism come down on the question of dispensationalism? Well, here's our perspective on it. We like it. We like dispensationalism. We think it was a good move in the right direction. But we don't believe that the dispensation of Israel ever ended. Am Yisrael Chai. How did that end? You know, the Jewish people are still alive. Instead, we see things in terms of redemption and exile. Yeah, there's dispensations. There's different periods of time. We call them redemption and exile. The current age is an age of exile. We are looking forward to a coming age of redemption. The Torah is still in force in both circumstances, but it applies differently by need of circumstance, whether there's a temple or not, for example, whether you're in the land or not, for example. It applies differently, but it's still an era of law. So dispensationalism got that one part wrong. God has not temporarily suspended his law. And my own ecclesiology does not so sharply divide Israel from the church. From my perspective, it's not bilateral ecclesiology as much as it is that Gentiles are privileged in Messiah to be brought into the nation of Israel and accorded a place within the family of God. So we are, so to speak, a part of greater Israel, the larger commonwealth of Israel, peoples who have been subjugated by the King of Israel, conquered. We are servants in the house of the King of Israel. So in that sense, there's no reason to speak of the age of Israel having expired at Pentecost and shifted to the church age. If anything, Israel has expanded dramatically during the exile, as men and women from all nations have come under the wings of the Shekinah, of the God of Israel. So I guess you could say that in Messianic Judaism, we do not fully endorse classical dispensationalist views, especially when they are used to set aside the Word of God by relegating it to an obsolete dispensation. Nevertheless, you have to give credit where credit is due. And we have to acknowledge the work of John Darby and the early dispensationalist thinkers and teachers who brought this light into the world, like Dwight Moody of Moody Press and Moody Bible Institute, and Cyrus Schofield of the Schofield Reference Bible, and many, many others who actually launched a theological revolution that took root and grew and has become so much the norm in Christianity today that most Christians in the Protestant evangelical type sectors don't even realize that it wasn't always like this, that we didn't always believe like this. And today there's bestsellers in movies, the Left Behind series, bestsellers in movies that wouldn't have been possible without dispensationalism. And from our perspective here in the Messianic movement, you know the old saying, if we've seen further than other men, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. And that's the case. I believe we have seen further. I do believe we have seen further. And that we have a responsibility to carry on the work. Does it make a difference? It's, because there's always some little voice in the back of your head saying, yeah, but what about, why don't you just take care of orphans and widows? What's all this theological, can we just be, does it make a difference? Yes. Here's why. Because the credibility of the whole gospel message stands on the Torah. And so long as we are proclaiming a Jesus who canceled the Torah, even if only the ceremonial laws, then we are presenting a false Messiah, a face of Antichrist. Whether he canceled it only temporarily by changing the dispensation from law to grace, or if he canceled it by revealing the truer, deeper spiritual significance of the commandments and allegorizing it all away like we were talking about last week, it makes no difference. If he canceled God's Torah, he is not the Messiah. He is not. He might be a very inspirational teacher. He might have been the first century equivalent of John Lennon. But he is not the Messiah promised by the prophets. So yes, it does make a difference. I stand on the truth, not just as I see it, but as the sages saw it, and as the apostles saw it, and as the prophets foresaw it. I stand on the words of Yeshua. For truly I say to you, he says, heaven and earth not until they pass away, will an iota or a jot or a tittle pass from the law until everything is accomplished. And when is everything accomplished? Not until the end of the last dispensation, the end of the kingdom of heaven, when the kingdom will usher us into the world to come. And this heaven and earth will be accomplished and pass away. Then all things will be accomplished. And if we can get that simple thing straight, then we can get back to the business of taking care of orphans and widows and living for the kingdom. That's part of our job in Messianic Judaism. Defending the Bible, defending the Torah, defending the reputation of our righteous Messiah.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.